Okay, so we are at 7:30, so welcome all. Welcome to any guests that have joined us. By all means, anytime guests are welcome at all PCU's good meetings, including Q&A. If you want to join our happy little band, it's only $20 a year, and you can I paste it into the chat where you can go to do that. If you go to our homepage, there's a join or renew button at the top, and you can join us up through that. The only other thing we've got, I will make an announcement that just a reminder to people that our annual general meeting is the February meeting. So it'll be the first order of business at our February meeting, which is the second Wednesday of the month. So that'll be February 12th. So I encourage everybody to join us for the AGM. And with that, I'm going to mute all. And as usual, you have the ability to unmute yourself, and if you do unmute yourself to ask a question or make a comment, please remute yourself afterwards. And later on this evening, Alan will be posting up onto our website the contents of the chat window, the deck that is being presented in PDF format, as well as the audio track. And with that, I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris, and welcome everyone. And in particular, I'd like to give a special welcome to a guest from Australia. Richard Bradford is here with us today. He attends a lot of APCUG meetings. So it's nice to see you here, Richard, at an OPCUG meeting. And I told him, although it's morning in Australia, I told him it's really cold here right now, so he should make sure he wears his parka and his toque. Okay, we have a lot of information tonight, different things as usual. I'm going to start off with one of our New Year's resolutions. Remember, Chris and I were going to do some more computer basics type things. And one of the things that came up from one of the one-on-one assistance programs was a question about rescue disks. So I thought I'd just spend a few minutes talking about rescue disks. And if you think about things, your computer's working great right now. And this is the time that you should make a rescue disk, because it's pointless trying to make a rescue disk on a computer that isn't actually working. And there are probably two recovery drives that you would like to have available. One is a Windows recovery drive, and for that you'll need a USB drive. And for Windows 10, it has to be 16 gigabytes, and for Windows 11, I'm told it has to be 32 gigabytes. Now, fortunately, USB drives are really cheap right now, so that can't be a problem, shouldn't be a problem. And the other one you might need is an emergency disk, a rescue disk for your backup system. And I've been using ESUS to do backup for a while, and it needs a 1 gigabyte or larger USB drive. It's a really small rescue disk. So those are the two. And of course, if you're not using ESUS, then you need a rescue disk for your particular disk imaging program if you're using disk images for backup. And if you're using something like Foxclone or RescueZilla, then you don't need a rescue disk because they run off live USBs anyway. So they are essentially their own rescue disk. You can boot from the backup medium, as it were. Okay, so we're not going to have time to do all of the above, so tonight we'll just talk a little bit about the Windows recovery drive and how you actually create that. And good old Microsoft, they really hide things like this away, make them difficult to find. And probably the easiest way to find it is to go to the search bar and type in recovery, and the first hit will be recovery drive. And that's what you want to actually run. And when you run it, you'll see that there's a checkbox down the bottom there, back up the system files to the recovery drive. And I recommend that you check that so that whatever it's giving you in terms of system files are actually available to you. And then once you check that box, then you can say next. And it will ask you, well, where do you want to create this? Rescue disk? Which flash drive do you want to use? And you can see on my system, it's actually found two drives. And the E drive, I very carefully named Windows 10 Rescue, so that's clearly the one I want to create my emergency disk for Windows. And the other one is actually a 64G SD card, which I use for basically real-time backup of my data drive. So you choose the one you want. In this case, it's going to be drive E. And it says that it's giving you a warning now. If this isn't a new drive, if you're reusing an old drive, it's telling you that everything on this drive is going to be trashed. So if you want to keep anything on this drive, then make sure you've copied it somewhere else, because by the time the smoke clears, anything you had on the drive will not be there anymore. But we're brave. We know that's what we want to do with this drive, so we're going to hit the Create button, and then it will give us a progress bar so we can see how it's doing and what it's doing. And eventually, after a few minutes, it will say that, yes, the recovery drive is ready, and you can hit the Finish button. And when you do that, if you go and look at the recovery drive, you can see that this is actually drive E. But you can also see that it's not called Windows 10 Rescue anymore. Microsoft, in their wisdom, decided that they knew best what to call this thing, so they've called it Recovery. I guess that's okay. I still know what it is. Not terribly obvious what's in there. There's an EFI partition, which is some kind of booting type mechanism. And there's some sources, which are probably all those things it asks you whether you wanted to copy or not. But the basic thing is, this is a bootable drive. So we actually don't care what's on it, just that there's something and it will actually work. And so what we need now is we need to know, how do we boot our computer from this USB drive? And most of you probably know that already. If you don't, then one of the things you can do is ask Mr. Google, or in this case, Mr. Perplexity AI, how do I boot my particular computer and make a model number from a USB drive? And mine is a Dell Inspiron laptop. And it tells me at the bottom there, well, all you have to do is power on the machine and press F12, and it will give you a one-time boot menu from which you can select the USB drive as the bootable medium. And once you boot it, then it will go into a Windows blue screen of life. And this is actually a blue screen, but it's the series of blue screens which get you where you want to be. And I love the first option on the top right here, turn off the PC. I mean, you just booted it, and now you're allowed to turn it off. That seems kind of weird. And you probably don't want to continue, because your problem is that the machines won't boot. So probably what we want to do is down here and hit Troubleshoot, where we can either reset the PC or we can see some advanced options. So something in there presumably is actually going to help us. And when we do that, then you can see that we do have the option to reset this PC, which is kind of a last resort, if you like, because it's going to refresh Windows and blow a whole bunch of stuff away. Basically, installed applications will go away and you have to reinstall them. But you do get the option to retain your personal files, and you hope that that works. Or hopefully you have that backup, which you can restore as you need to. But what we're probably going to do is we want to go to advanced options and do something in there. So here are all the different things that you can do with advanced options. And one of the first things I would try is this startup repair, because if your machine is not booting, it may be something simple. There's some Windows glitch somewhere, and the software here may be able to fix it. And if that doesn't work, then you'll have to try something else, and Mr. Google will advise you all the good things that you can do. So that's basically how to create and how to at least start using a Windows emergency drive. So if you don't have one, I highly recommend that you make one. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Chris, who has a share on a newsletter.
And I will do that as soon as you give me slide control.
I should do that, shouldn't I? Right,
as you're finding that, I've got a bunch I can talk to here. So the Ouch newsletter, it's put out by the SANS organization. SANS stands for the Sysadmin Audit Network and Security. They're an education, security education organization. They have certifications as well as a lot of educational material on the website, and they have courses and so forth for people that are interested in security on PCs. The Ouch newsletter was created quite a few years ago, and I have a bit of a soft spot for it. I used to be on the community review board for the newsletter until they disbanded the newsletter disbanded the community review committee at some point. I don't know why. But at any rate, what it is it's a free monthly security newsletter, and it's all about cybersecurity. It's really aimed at the everyday person out there, not at sysadmins or anything like that. It provides very actionable things. So it'll propose a particular problem that you might have in security and then what you can actually do about it. Very accessible language. It's written in non-technical language that anybody should be able to understand. They say it's researched by a team of security experts. I don't doubt that at all, being the SANS organization. They have a lot of resources that can ensure that the information is correct. 2 pages maximum. So it's a very quick read. And you can just read it online, or you can actually subscribe to a mailing list and have it mailed to you. And the URL is there, and I will paste that into the chat as soon as I'm done here. So, just as a sample, here's the newsletter that came out for January of this year. So the headline for it was Digital Nightmare, Cyber Criminals Inside Your Home. So that's to grab your attention. And then they talk about, you know, what exactly are the smart home devices that we should be concerned about? And then once you understand what it is about, what are those devices, why is it actually important to actually secure them? And then they go into, oops, click one too many. Then they had 5 things you can actually do to secure the home devices. And so change default passwords and multi-factor authentication, all the same things that we are all familiar with, but it's very concise and very easy to digest information for everybody. And so I highly recommend that you check them out. You can get the email, as I said, emailed to you. You can pick up the information on the website, and they have back issues going back years now of very useful information in there. And so that's all I had on there. And I don't see anything in the chat, so I'll carry on because I think this one is mine as well. So accidental shutdown. So this is going into the computer basics because this is something that I'm a little bit embarrassed to actually admit to the fact that I had a problem with this. My last laptop that I had was the Lenovo Slim Pro. And to me, it was a really poor design where they placed the power switch on it. It was on the side of the computer rather than on the top deck or at the top of the screen or something like that. And several times when I was pushing on some device to plug it in on the left side of it, I was bracing the computer so that I wasn't pushing the laptop across the desktop, and I would end up hitting the power switch accidentally and turn off the laptop. Needless to say, when I'm in the middle of a presentation in front of a dozen people or something like that, that's a little bit embarrassing to have to sit there and wait for the computer to come back to life. And then recently I brought a new laptop, an Asus ProArt PX13, and it had, to me, the same poor design. The power button was on the side. The power button's a little bit better on that in that it's closer to the front of the computer where I'm not likely to be grabbing if I'm bracing to hold it against pushing on the other side. The button is a little bit stiffer and a little bit more prominent, so it's not as easy to hit, but it really is still too easy to hit. And then while I was configuring this new computer with all of the standard setup that I wanted in Windows, I realized that Windows has an option where you can configure the power button to actually do different things. And I knew this from way back, and I don't know why it lives for so long on my Lenovo of having this particular problem without thinking, I can actually do something about this. So where you go is Control Panel, and then power options. So this is one of the settings that has not been migrated to settings yet. So you have to run it from control panel, power options, and then there's an option there for choose what the power button does. And then when you do that, you get a drop-down menu. You can have it do nothing. So if you press the power button, nothing happens at all. The only way to shut down the computer then is from the start menu. You can set it to sleep, hibernate, or shut down. And you may see a little bit difference in there of what options you have available depending on the configuration of your computer itself. So what I suggest is that when you, if you have this problem like I had, set that to either do nothing or just go into sleep mode and set it for both on battery or plugged in. And that way you won't accidentally shut down your computer when you're in the middle of using it. And the sleep is not a bad option because I can use it to actually purposefully put the computer to sleep. If I accidentally put it to sleep, I press any key and a second later it's back to life. So that's all I had to share on that. So if you have a laptop and the power button, you might want to look into that to see if you want to have something other than shutdown as your option on that.
Can I add in, Chris, to that?
Yep.
So just to tell a funny story, I was presenting at Carlingwood Library, and Chris, long story, but I ended up using Chris's laptop that he mentioned on his first slide. Except he had to leave to go attend an OPCUG board meeting. My finger hit that button. It powered off, so my audience is waiting for me to power it back on, and I don't know his password. So I had to phone the OPCUG board meeting and interrupt him and pray he would answer the phone so I could get back to my presentation.
Yeah, that would have been embarrassing. I guess it would have been problematic if I hadn't answered the phone. That was fortunate. Thanks,
sure,
Linda.
You saw the question there from Stu. If the power button does nothing, how do you power it back on?
Yeah, and that's what. How power it back on? It only is the shutdown function of it when the computer is powered on that Windows can actually control what that button does. When the computer is powered off, Windows has no control over that button, so it works as a power on.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Those cautionary tales, I guess. Thanks, Chris and Linda. Okay, moving along then, we have part two of Jocelyn Dwar's item on GNU Cache. And Joss, I believe you're going to share your screen.
Yes.
And run your slides.
Mr. Sherm.
Oh, sorry.
Chris has to make your co-host.
Yep. Yeah. There you go.
Okay. Okay, so I hope you can see my.
It should be coming up here. There we go. Okay.
Okay. So let me move this one out of the way. All right. So I think everybody can see me now.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, one thing I will try to do is to wait a little bit when I change the slides because there was some hiccup last week, so hopefully that won't happen again. All right. Okay, one thing I did mention last week is that you can create all kind of setup for the accounts. And when you start a new file, it will give you a whole options. So that's, and you can in it fill up all your sets of accounts, and you can easily remove or add more as you need. So that might be a good way to start, or in my case, most of the time I want to start from myself because I know exactly what I want, but that's up to you to change. Okay, one of the thing about GNU Cache that might be surprising to many people is when they start is there is no undo. So if you do something and you want to backtrack, there's no such things as an undo button or anything like that. And the reason for that is that this is an accounting software. So it might be, especially if you're running a business or something like that, you may create reports, you may create documentation and you copy files. And if someone wants to do an audit, they will see two different sets of books. And that can create confusion and can be very hard to track, okay, what happened in between the time, the change you made and the time and now. So as accounting, one of the accounting principles is that you don't change old data. What you do is you create a new transaction that documents the change and the reason for the change. So that way, when someone who does an audit or verify the thing, they can compare exactly what happened and why that happened. So there is no peekaboo kind of changes that may create problems. So that's a simple thing that might be confusing, but that's a good thing in the long run. Now, it doesn't mean that you cannot change data. You can change things back, but just be careful. Okay. Last week, I talked about simple transaction where there was always two parts. But there are many times where there are more than two parts. There can be three, four, and so on. For example, when you receive a paycheck, there is several deductions that can appear on it. And this is one transaction, but with multiple parts. And with NewCash, you can create as many splits as you want. For example, one of the things that when you receive money on PayPal, there are always PayPal fees. So what you do is you enter the amount that you received, and on the other column, you enter two things. One is the fees and the actual amount that you received. Now, when you create that, one thing you have to be careful is to make sure that all the numbers does balance. And if they don't, for example, in this case, there was a difference of $1, NewCash will automatically create a new entry, and it will call it imbalance. Canadian in this case. So you can easily go back in the list of accounts, open the imbalance, and you can see where things don't balance. So then you need to, that's something that needs to be corrected as you go along. Okay. One thing that it has also is scheduled transaction. For example, one thing I like to use it, the bank fees. Every month, there is a bank fees that is added automatically to the bank account. I can do it manually, or I can create a scheduled transaction. So for that, you click on action. Oops, sorry. You click on action. Click on the schedule transaction, schedule editor, and it will open an editor that gives you all kind of options. You can enter it every month or at the end of the month, or there's a lot of different options. And once everything is set up, when you open the file again, it will give you a menu asking, is it okay to enter this transaction automatically? And you just say yes or no. And most of the time, that's what you want. One thing you can do to make it easier is that if you can use an existing transaction and use that as a template and simply select create a scheduled transaction from that template so that you don't have to enter the same thing. So that's a convenient thing to have. NewCash supports any number of currency. You can have US dollars or any euro or anything. What you do for that is that when you create a new account, you tell it that you tell it what is the currency that you are using, and automatically everything will be stored in that account in the currency that you want. For example, with PayPal, you can receive money in American dollars or US dollars. So you can have two PayPal accounts, one in Canadian and one in the US dollars. But when you do the transfer, there is always an exchange rate. So when you say, okay, you transfer the money from PayPal to your Canadian bank, and it will ask you what is the exchange rate, or if you want, enter the amount that it will be deposited in your bank account. So one or the other, but they are equivalent. It's just that if you enter exchange rate, it will do the conversion for you, and if you select the amount, it will just enter the amount that was deposited in your bank account. When you are dealing with customers that are all over the world, it's often more convenient to display your price in American dollars. That way, that it's the kind of currency that's often more support, is more used all over the world. But everything should be entered in Canadian dollar in Nucash, except for the account that is in the American dollars, for example. So that way I keep only the PayPal where I receive the money for the business in American dollars, but everything is in the customers, the bill, all the when you do the transfer. Now, Nucash does not store fractions of a dollar. It stores dollars and cents on both sides, on the American side and the Canadian side, for example. So that can create some rounding errors. And that's something that I struggled for a little while. And what I found out is that you should enter the amount in the larger value side. So when you convert the thing in the other side and store only dollars and cents, it will get the accurate value for both Canadian value and the American dollar. Because when it does a rounding, it goes from big to small, that works. But if you do the other way around, you will see that sometimes there is a rounding problem, and that gives you a problem. Okay. As a business, you have to deal with HST. And as a business, you are not paying HST, you're not receiving HST, you are sort of the transmitter. So the question that I had for you, if you want to think a little bit about it, is what two accounts where the HST should appear? Should it be an expense, should it be a liability, or should it be an income? Because it could be, I guess, you're receiving money, but that money that you receive, you owe that to the government. And when you give it to the government, is it an expense? So that's the kind of question that I sometimes at the beginning have to struggle, because I can convince myself that all three are possible. So that takes some time to figure out the right place to put stuff. So the answer to that is, what you do is you put the HST as a liability. Because whatever money you receive, you have to send back to the government. But also, if you pay for equipment in Canadian dollars at a Canadian store, you will get some HST. But what you do is you enter as a negative number in the other column of the HST account. And where you can get fairly complicated at the beginning is where to put, which column to put the amount. And this is an example where I had received money in American dollars. They paid, I paid for the PayPal fee, but the customer also paid for the HST and for the actual order. So in this case, I have four splits in the thing. And it took me quite a while to figure out which column to put the thing. But once you have put everything in the column, you will see that everything balances out. If they don't balance, it's because probably you have put things in the wrong amount. And it takes some thinking to get that thing in the right place. So just a little times that you have to be think about where to put things. As a business, you probably will need also to send bills, and you will get also invoices. Again, I'm asking you, should it be an income, a liability, or something else? As a business, often when you send an invoice, you don't get paid right away. You will get something like, for example, due in 30 days. And if they are not paid on time, then you get a late fees. And that's something that NewCash can help you with all that. They work very much the same way, except that you reverse the process for what is added and what is removed. So the steps are the same, except that in one case you select an invoice and the other case you select a bill. So under business, you start anew. The first thing you need to do is first to create a customer or a supplier. So under business, you can create all the, you can enter all the information about the customer, for example, the address, the name. You can create a customer number and company name and so on and so on. So you can enter all the parameters for the people you're dealing with. Once the customer or the supplier is entered, then you start, you can create a new invoice and you select the customer where it, who will be invoiced, and you enter all the information about the date, the name of the name of the customer, the amount, the date. You can enter tax information. There's a number of different parameters you can enter. So this is a subject all by itself, so I'm not going to go into great details. But that's one way, that's how you can create invoice or bills. You can also format your invoice. So for example, in this case, I had the logo, the address, the terms, all kind of information. You can format different things. That also is a whole subject by itself. So you can enter a CSS code. So there's, it's quite complicated, and but in order to get exactly what you want, but it takes, but it can be done. Or you can just go for the default and simply use whatever is available there. Okay. Once you have written the invoice or the bill, you need to post it. Basically, it's, that's when you are sending the invoice to the customer, for example. And it becomes posted. And when it is posted, then you can get all kinds of tables showing, okay, this customer has this invoice, and so on. So you can get a whole list. So you can display the data in multiple ways. You can also search for the invoice. You can search for the customers. You can search for a number of things, and it will show you also for things like, for example, we have when are the bills due? Is it in 30 days, 60 days, or when is it overdue? So it helps you keep track what is due, what is receivable, and so on. And when you start NuCash, you open a new file, it will show you a reminder that this invoice is now due, and you can look at the one. If you want to pay the invoice, then you can click on process the payment, and then you enter where the money will come from and where it goes. So that way, it's a nice way to sort of not forgetting the transaction and the invoice. Okay, on a different subject, at the end of the year, you need to provide all the data, all the records for the income tax and for the auditor if you're going through an audit and all that stuff. So there are two ways to deal with a new year. One is to simply save all the accounts, to export all the accounts and create a NuCash file, which will have all the accounts, but all the transaction will be removed, so you can start from fresh. Or the other option is to keep all the data that you have before, but simply change the accounting period. So that way, when you create the reports, it will show you what is in 2025, for example. Or if you want to do a monthly report, you can just select for this month. So the accounting period is adjustable for the whole NuCash file or for just one of the reports. So it's up to you. So there is pros and cons. Having an export mix gives you a file that is totally clean, but changing the accounting period can be useful because you can look at the old previous data, so you can duplicate that old data. So it's up to you how you want to deal with that. Okay, my conclusion. When I started NuCash, I had no accounting experience at all. But I found that the manual that is included in NuCash are very well written, and I learned a lot about accounting. And now after doing all that, I have a lot more respect for the accounting because it's not so simple. I'm doing things that are not that difficult, but I can imagine it can get pretty difficult. And now I understand why it takes years of study to do that. But if you stick to it, if you're doing properly, and you will find that you can trust your books and you will get a much better picture of your finances. So that's it for me. So if you have any questions, let me know.
The only comment I see is from Alan, and Alan, I don't exactly understand what it is you're saying. So, do you want?
I just wondered whether people understood what Justin was talking about when he's saying posting, as opposed to mailing.
Oh, I see.
Talk about posting transactions to the accounting system, whereas you probably mail invoices through Canada Post to customers.
No,
so there is a slight difference between post and mail.
Yeah, it's not that kind of posting. It's more, I'm trying to see the chat. The posting is that you can write the invoice 2 days ahead of time, but when you are ready to send it to the customer, this is when you actually post the invoice or the bill. So that means that it will be added to account payable and account receivable, because And those accounts are, when, for example, payment account receivable is an asset, because you have that money, but not yet you owe, you have, but you have not received it yet. So that's what posting means, is that it is now added to the assets, but it is not yet received. I hope that explains, that makes sense.
I think so, yeah. And Harvey posted a thing in the chat. If you want to learn more about accounting, he posted a link to a site called Accounting Cat, a Coach, so you can check that out. Okay. And I don't see anything else in the chat as it stands now, other than a couple of thanks. So thanks, Joss.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much, Joss.
You're welcome.
Okay, so we'll move along, and our next item is another AI presentation from our AI guru, Bob Harris.
Okay, thank you, Alan, and thank you, Jocelyn. Thank you. Okay, tonight I'd like to share with you my new secret weapon for easy photo editing. So, a few years back, I bought a new computer, and I still got that, and I bought some very fancy photo editing software. I still have that software, but I really rarely use it. I usually want something just quick and simple and easy. And I was using mostly, I'd use an online tool called cleanup.pictures. You just slide your photograph into that, dump it on there, drag it up, load it, whatever you want, and it'll remove any object from you. And this used to do an amazing job for me, used to do. Okay? And while we're on the same topic, to remove and edit backgrounds, I use remove.bg. Chris mentioned this a long time ago. I've been using it ever since. I do not even have this one bookmarked. I just type in remove.bg, and I'm still using remove.bg today, but I'm no longer using cleanup.pictures because I saw this in the news last week. Last week in PC World, Microsoft Paint adds AI feature that erases objects and images. I thought, well, that's interesting, okay. But then, a second article. CNN Business says, Microsoft added AI to software it had barely touched since 1985. The results are astonishing. Now I'm curious. So I checked it out, only to discover I already had this software and I didn't know it. It had quietly arrived on a Windows 11 update a whole 2 days before I read this article. So here I am on the lookout for the next big thing. Little did I know, it was right under my nose. Gee. So, I use Windows 11. If you're on Windows 10, I think you can still get it. I believe you have to do something or update your Microsoft Photo app. I can't tell you a lot about that. I do not have Windows 10. So you might be able to get the generative AI eraser. You have Windows 10 with an update. Check that out and good luck. Let's keep going forward. I want to tell you about my mouse problem. Yes, this is my mouse problem. I opened my computer mouse up, and I found a real mouse inside. Now I'm getting tired of feeding it. I'm running out of cheese. I need a solution. I know you wouldn't believe me, so I got a photograph for you. Here it is. And yes, you guessed it. I will be using the AI-powered generative eraser in Microsoft Paint to remove this mouse. So you're asking, how do I use this generative erase in Microsoft Paint? You open your Microsoft Paint program, select generative erase, click on the unwanted object, and watch it disappear. Yes, folks, it really is that easy. You'll see a slider column on the left-hand side. That slider controls the size of your eraser. Just use your mouse, and it'll magically fill in. Here's before and after pictures, and there's a slider in the left-hand side. You can see that. This is an actual, it's hard to see, the screenshot from Microsoft Paint. We'll go forward, please. And here we are. And this presentation is not being sponsored by a junk removal company. But all you have to do is point. It will disappear. And this one is true. I received a funny graphic by email. It said, a rare photograph of my parents on their way to school. Well, I erased the text on a clear blue sky and saved a second graphic. Then I added my text, the second new graphic, and I said, here they are going back home, going uphill, of course, whatever. Then I replied with both graphics. The point here is that I didn't use my picture thing, whatever. I used my generative eraser here in Paint, and I did this in 60 seconds. I'm not fooling you. In 60 seconds. It's a cool tool. I like graphics, photographs, and stuff. You'll enjoy this. And the next slide, please. So, the new generative AI eraser in Microsoft Paint. It's fast, easy to use, completely free. So, in the past, I used cleanup.pictures to zap the unwanted stuff from my graphics and pictures and photos. It was quick and easy and free. I want to thank, this is much better. Thank Chris for pointing out that cleanup.pictures only gave me low resolution images, which is usually fine for most of my stuff. But the new AI eraser in Paint works in high resolution. You can use this on anything and everything, even important things like your best photographs and stuff. This is a cool tool. It's my favorite now. And maybe Chris can clarify what I missed on that differences, please, Chris, and thank you everybody for watching.
Yeah, no, that's it. It's just that a lot of these free tools like the background removal or object removal and things like that, if you're willing to pay, you can get with high resolution images and so forth, but free accounts generally really limit you. One of the ones that Bob was talking about, it limits your output file to 0.25 megapixel. Some of them will just tell you a vertical resolution of 720 pixels or something like that, which for me is pretty useless for any of the uses that I would have for it. But when you can work in things like Microsoft Paint, where you are not limited in the resolution, anything that Paint can handle, you can use the generative erase on it, much more flexible for you.
The other thing that I might want to just point out, just because of my particular experience with multiple camera clubs around Ottawa, there isn't a single club right now that would allow you to enter a photo into a competition that uses generative AI. There's other things you can do. You can do some smart erasing and foam brush and things like that, but generative means they're creating things away from your image and bringing them in potentially, and so just so people are aware of that.
In this case in particular, I don't think it is actually really using that sense of AI generation. You have to be careful.
Wording generative AI in most clubs, that's enough to eliminate it, even if it was only using your pixels.
Yeah.
It must use some, because Chris, it does fill back in the color with anything.
Yeah.
You want it, the blue sky or the chair, you name it.
But some of the generative AI, it doesn't restrict itself to that. So it will go off, like if you had a branch and you wanted, and you had like an ugly leaf on it, and you wanted a nice looking leaf, it will give you a nice looking leaf, but it didn't find it from another part of your photo.
Yep.
Yeah. You'll get that in generative fill in particular. Like you'll have a field and you'll say, give me a puppy in the middle of the field. Well, it'll generate a puppy. Well, it's not from the pixels in your image. And so that's no-no when it comes to photo contests for sure.
But it's just for your own pleasure. There's nothing wrong with it. I just want to give people a warning.
Yep. Good point.
Sorry, Bob, I missed where you can get to the tool. I have Windows 11, 24H2, I believe.
Oh, yeah. Just open Microsoft Paint.
Yeah. I'm in Paint now, and I don't see the tool.
You see the eraser in Paint?
Okay, I see it now. Okay.
You want to click on the eraser in the top center? Oh, can we go back two slides, please, Alan?
I see the slide on the left there.
One more slide back, sorry. Right there. On the top, my mouse can't show on your screen, of course, but there's a, under the R in Really, there's an eraser right there. Click on that one. That's the manual eraser. When that one's activated, the bottom one on the left can be activated next for the generative eraser. So the default one is the simple eraser. And then when that one is engaged, you can go to power it up with the generative eraser below and then change the slider bigger or smaller. And as Chris pointed out here, this mouse has 3 back feet here, but I didn't notice that before. It's really powerful.
And Jeff, just notes that he looked on Google and AI generative erase should be available for Windows 10.
Great.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Bob.
Thank you.
Get the slides ahead. And
great.
The next item is mine. Okay, so this is a quick thing about ejecting USB drives. And normally there's an icon available in Windows, this is Windows 10, where you can click on this little flash drive icon and it will give you the option to erase the drives, eject the drive. The chevron here is the hidden icons. You can go in there and actually grab this icon and drag it onto the taskbar so that it's always available. And I don't believe you actually need to use it these days with the patches they've made to Windows, but I still like to click on this guy, and then it gives me the option to eject my USB flash drive. I click on that, and I get this message that says, okay, it is safe to remove the hardware. So all of the caching has been written out to the drive, and the drive is now available to be removed without the possibility of losing any data. So here's the same kind of thing when I use a regular user's account. I just click on that and I get the option to eject the drive. However, suddenly one of these days, the previous one where I got the little message popping up with my admin account. Recently, when I used my regular user's account, when I do that, I used to get the toast. But now I click on this guy here to eject the drive, and nothing seems to have happened. The little warning message or the notification message has gone away. So, you know, I like using Google and AI and stuff. So I ask it, well, how do I safely remove this? How do I get this message back? It's not giving me this notification anymore. And it gave me a whole bunch of things to do, check the notification settings, restart Explorer, do all kinds of wonderful things. I did all of those things, and basically nothing happened. None of the so-called fixes actually fixed anything. So I tried a different approach. I said, how about writing me a batch file for Windows that will eject the USB drive, and I gave it the drive U because I've called my USB drive U under Windows, and then display a message telling me whether you were successful or not. And you can probably see here that it's given me some batch file commands, and it's using this program called Remove Drive, and it tells me in the instructions that Remove Drive is actually a utility from a guy in Germany. So you have to go to his website, download his program, and then you're able to use it. So here's the actual batch file. So it's using a PowerShell command, obviously quite a long one, and because it's got the various prompts in here to tell me it's been safely ejected or that it didn't work. But basically, I just create a text file, call it .bat, safely eject drive.bat, and then now I can load that thing onto my desktop. So I have an icon here which will, when I double click on that icon, it will run that batch file. And sure enough, when I tell it to safely eject, then it ejects the drive and gives me this message in green to say that the USB drive has been safely ejected. And it's a fail-safe prompt because if I run it a second time, it says it failed to eject, and that's because it's already been ejected. So at least for me, now I know that my USB drive is being ejected correctly. So I'm a happy camper. Okay, so I don't know any questions on anything, Chris?
Nope, don't see anything in the chat.
In the last 10, so we can ask, are there any other questions or anything that people would like to share in the last 4 minutes, I guess, rather than 10? So giving everybody a chance to think, unmute their microphones, type into the chat window. Well, while they're thinking about it, I will just go on with the wrap-up slides as usual. And I'll just remind members of the club that we have this one-on-one remote assistance program. So if you have a problem, you're certainly entitled or encouraged to send it to suggestionbox@opcg.ca, and we'll try and answer it as part of Q&A. But if it's something that really requires somebody to look at your computer screen and figure out what's going on, then we're able to get one of our volunteers to dial into your machine essentially over the internet and be able to see your machine and troubleshoot programs using this remote assistance capability. So far, it's been very successful. If you have that kind of problem, we encourage you to send in a request and we'll see what we can do. If you are not a member of the club, we have a special offer right now until March 31st. If you join the club and send us $20, which is the one-year membership fee, we will give you a second year of membership absolutely free. So it's basically a two-for-one offer and 2 years membership for the price of one. But if you are a member, then please don't renew to get an extra year because the board of directors has already decided that we are going to waive membership fees for the next year for existing members. So your membership expiry date will be extended by another year at absolutely no cost to you. So if you're not a member, you can join and get two for one. If you are a member, keep your money in your wallet or buy your wife a present or something. Your spouse a present, sorry about that. Friend a present. Okay, one of the other things that we do, or Chris and Linda do a lot, is giving presentations at various branches of the Ottawa Public Library. And the ones that are coming up shortly, tomorrow in fact, Chris is doing his PC tips on enhancing performance at Centennial, and that's in the afternoon at 2 o'clock. If you want to know more about backup, why you need that emergency backup disk, you need a backup system first, and Chris will explain why you need a backup and what are the tools that will get you to do the job. And that's at Manatic on January 28th. And keeping passwords safe, one of his favorite presentations, at Rockcliffe Park on the 30th. And all those things and others are posted on the library's website, and you'll need to register for any of those through the library system there. Next month, February the 12th, is our regular monthly meeting, and guess who? We have Chris, who's going to be giving his presentation on how to buy a PC. So if you have a Windows 10 PC, remember that Windows 10 is going to reach end of life in October. So you're going to have to do something about your operating system. Upgrade to Windows 11 if you can. If you can't, then there are various options, one of which is buy a new PC because it will come with Windows 11 pre-installed. However, the question is, what should you buy, and what should you be looking for when you go to buy? And all of those questions Chris will be answering at our next meeting, next monthly meeting on February the 12th.
And if anybody thinks that they've already seen this presentation that I've given, I've added a fair amount of information, including the new Copilot PCs. So if you're interested in, or you've been thinking about whether you should be looking towards a Copilot PC, there are some gotchas that you might want to watch out for. Some definite benefits on the Copilot PCs, but definite things to avoid on that as well.
Yes, your question here, is there an easy way to find out what programs still have files open? I use a utility program called, good question, what's my utility?
One of the power toys will do it.
Okay, I use a program called Lock Hunter.
Yeah.
And it basically will tell you which programs are holding things open so you can't do certain things. What's the power toy, Chris?
Yeah, I've used Lock Hunter as well. It works really well. I gave it up only because of the fact that it was included now automatically as one of the power toys. And let me look at the names of them. File Locksmith is one of the power toys. Basically does the same thing. So I stopped using Lock Hunter just because File Locksmith was going to be installed anyways as part of the power toys, and it seems to do a good job.
And there's a question here which various, I think Joss is answering. And how do you force shutdown reboot if a battery-powered tablet PC crashes when the shutdown button is disabled?
And that, I think the long and short of it is that if you hold down the power button for like 10 seconds, it should shut down the machine no matter what.
Yeah, certainly that usually works.
Yeah.
Okay, I think we've covered all the questions in the chat there. So our next meeting will be next week, next Wednesday, January 29th. If you have any questions, if you have feedback on the questions that were answered tonight, additional information or whatever, or if you have topics that you'd like to share, pretty much along the lines of what Bob did or Joss did, just send us a few details, send your questions, send a few details or your share to our suggestion box address, and we'll be sure to put you on the agenda. So it's been a pretty full night, fast-paced, I think. I hope everybody enjoyed things, and we'll see you all next week.
Thanks for coming, folks. We'll see you next Wednesday.